and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A ESP. Again, that's Nick A ESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we have got an insanely awesome show for you today. I'm obviously still social distancing here in my home studio, but we are going to be actually talking about a constitutional or potential constitutional crisis with President Trump because some of his data is being held hostage by hackers. And you may not have seen this in the news, and I'm going to fill you in because this is insane. And the other thing that is really, really interesting that we're going to be doing is I actually sat down a short while ago and spoke with President Obama's former cybersecurity advisor in the White House. He sat on the National Security Council. He was directly responsible for White House security, and now he is running the internationally known Cyber Threat Alliance. You are going to meet Michael Daniel. This is a fascinating, fascinating interview I've got for you in my deep dive. And stick around because, as always, we're going to start with the news. And to get started, I have to tell you about the situation that our president currently finds himself in. Now, with that, let me give you some backstory because I've actually been reporting on this on my daily podcasts and videos for the last few weeks or so. But let me catch you up here, on the radio. Now, a few weeks ago, a law firm out of New York called Grubman, Shire, Mysalas, and Sachs, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, had a data breach. They got hit by a group called R-Evil or Reval, and they stole a ton of information. Now, what makes the Grubman, and I'm just going to say Grubman law firm, very special is that they are considered the law firm to the stars. Everybody from Elton John to Lady Gaga to Bono uses Grubman to do a lot of their work. And so the information that they would have would be personal correspondence, sensitive information, non-disclosure agreements, all of this. And so when the hackers are evil or Reval found out what they had, they went to Grubman and said, we're going to put this online unless you give us $21 million. And so what happened was Alan Grubman, the head of the firm, basically went out and said, no, we are not going to do this. We've been talking with the police with the FBI. And by virtue of what the FBI is saying, they are going to classify this as a terrorist act because of the sensitive nature for all of these high profile people. And so by virtue of that, I am catching you up to the latest news that just happened in the last few days as I'm sitting here talking to you. And depending on what station you're listening, it could have been 2 days, it could have been a week. But this is what is happening because after the FBI classified this ransomware threat to publish the stolen data, they went ahead and came out and said that Reval came out and said, we have information on President Trump. And if he wants to basically remain elected, stay in office or win the next election, you are now going to pay us $42 million. They doubled the ransom, and they published the first batch of emails related to Donald Trump that they had. Now, this was seemingly triggered by the terrorism classification, according to the sources here. But the ransom note that Reval wrote says, and I quote, and forgive the broken English here, but I'm going to read this verbatim. We read the position of the authorities. Declare this an act of terrorism. Your position is your choice. This will not affect our work in any way. It's just that it can completely erase certain frames that we still observed. But now this is not that. Mr. Lawyer, presumably Alan Grubman, says that Donald has never been their client, and he says that we are bluffing. Oh, well, the first part, which is the most harmless information, we will post here. And at the end of the ransom note, there was a link to 3 dark web downloads with a password to access these files so that we could all take a look at it. And it is interesting, let me tell you. And the note ends, and I quote, oh, yes, Donald, here is the first part of the data,
And sure enough, they did. Now, these downloads, as I mentioned, link to a total of 169 emails that mentioned Trump in one way or the other. And pretty much true to their word, these were pretty harmless, as they mentioned. It looks like they probably just went for the data that they had and went searching for any mention of Trump. And they lumped those emails together into a file that were very basic. And this is pretty much as far from, you know, like dirty laundry, if you will, as you can get. But it shows that they do have documents pertaining to President Trump. One of the ones that I read, for example, was basically Trump talking about President Trump, excuse me, I believe then candidate Trump, talking about to lawyers Hillary Clinton's use of, let's say, an old video of him on the David Letterman show, which, okay, it's pretty innocuous, but it shows that they have this here. And so we don't know what's going to happen. This could either be seriously damning or a whole lot of nothing if Grubman doesn't pay this fine, and we are going to about to pay out. Now, the Grubman law firm has also said that Donald Trump was never a client of theirs. So let's go through this and let's walk out and game out these implications here. So first, if President Trump was not a client of Grubman, then what Grubman would have on President Trump would be email correspondence, confidential documents like non-disclosure agreements, and more if President Trump, I'm assuming then just Donald Trump, was engaged with a Grubman client or clients, since a ton of celebrities use Grubman. I think that's a very real possibility that in some way, shape, or form, these celebrities are going to be in his orbit. Obviously, he ran a show called Celebrity Apprentice that literally brought celebrities, to him. So I think that's a real possibility. Now, if President Trump was a client of Grubman, which is possible, although from what I understand, Michael Cohen was his personal lawyer prior, obviously, to Cohen's conviction, I want to say like a year or two ago or so, then Grubman would have all of that information I just mentioned and a ton more, because they would be doing a lot of this work for Donald Trump, then Donald Trump, now President Trump. Now, here's the thing, love him or hate him, he is the president of the United States of America, which means that one of the leaders of a world power here is literally being held ransom by an unknown group of cyber criminals that we presume in the intelligence community and in cybersecurity are not in this country. So the national security implications of this are rather profound. If these attackers have something so damning on President Trump that it affects his judgment in this situation, then do we have a constitutional crisis on our hands? Would the president need to temporarily abdicate his authority to Vice President Pence while he is under this threat? I mean, imagine this. Imagine he uses Grubman and these guys come in and say, oh, yes, we have all of your secret documents, Mr. President, and we're going to dump them, unless you pay us. What if they really do have bomb dropping, oh, my God, should never see the light of day, you know, in terms of what the president would and would not want to share with the public, and they've got it. Can his judgment be trusted? Could any president's judgment? This goes beyond President Trump. Although I have to say, this is probably the first time in history that I know of, and I did my homework, that a president is being held hostage, in a situation like this. And that's essentially what it is. This data could be very damning, and it's unprecedented. And so I think this is something that we need to address. And so that's what's going on with President Trump. You know, I'd be curious to see how this plays out. I don't see him abdicating his authority in this situation, but I think in this case, he may have to. And what does that look like? Because you're not removing him from office. You are simply excising him from the decision-making process of this one specific situation. So I'd be curious to see how this plays out. And you know, I'll bringing you updates on that. But that is what is going on with President Trump.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM.
And in Facebook news, and honestly, I could probably have made this a deep dive, but we have to talk about Facebook, because the question that I've got in my brain is Facebook actually cleaning up its act, or is it being a censor? And I'm sure all of you are going to have your own opinion on this, but here's what's going on. Basically, Facebook announced the first members of its oversight board that will decide what controversial content is allowed on Facebook and Instagram. Facebook has announced the new members of the Supreme Court, And basically, these people are very heavy hitters, and we will get to that. But a couple of weeks ago, Facebook published the names of their first 20 members of their independent oversight board. And it basically, this board will be able to overturn decisions by Facebook and its founder and CEO, Mark Zuckerberg, about policing the social network. So this is basically a high-profile response to criticism on how Facebook has been handling problematic content. And we have seen fake news run rampant on this. The one that fits into my circles more and more that I see is this whole like 5G is going to, you know, cause the coronavirus or spread it. And so people have been burning 5G cell towers. That originated in a Facebook group, and it is running rampant in the United Kingdom right now. They've had something like 80 to 100 5G cell towers burned as a result of just massive misinformation on that platform. So Facebook said these board members, the ones that they've released so far, have lived in 27 countries and speak at least 29 languages, though a quarter of the group and two of the four co-chairs are from the United States, which is where the company is headquartered, which also makes sense because I believe if you're looking at country population, the United States, hands down, is the largest Facebook population as well. And so there we are. The co-chairs, though, who selected the members jointly with Facebook, are former U.S. Federal Circuit Judge and religious freedom expert Michael McConnell, constitutional law expert Jamal Green, Colombian attorney Catalina Botero Marino, and former Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt. Among those in the initial cohort, are also former European Court of Human Rights Judge Andreas Sajo, Internet Sans Frontiers, basically Internet Without Borders from France, their executive director, Julie Owano, Yemeni Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Tawakkol Karman, Australian Internet Governance researcher, Nicholas Suzar, and Pakistani digital rights advocate, Nijat Dad. Now, this is a clearly international group of intellectuals that are coming together for this. Now, this board, which will grow to about 40 members and which Facebook has pledged $130 million to fund for at least 6 years, will make public binding decisions on a small slice of controversial cases where users have exhausted Facebook's usual appeal process. The company can also refer significant decisions to this board, including on ads or Facebook groups. Now, to quote co-chair McConnell, who told reporters in a conference call, "We are not the internet police. Don't think of us as sort of a fast action group that's going to swoop in and deal with rapidly moving problems." Basically, this board would deliver an after the fact deliberative second look. And so by virtue of that, if you are putting out, let's say, something that Facebook deems inappropriate and you've gone through their appeals process, it will eventually end up here, and that has to be a very egregious case. Now, here are my thoughts on this, because I find this interesting. First, let's get the optics for Zuckerberg out of the way. His track record about actually caring about his billions of users is just dismal and void of empathy. So by virtue of this, I could see this partially as a move for him to pass the buck. Like, "Don't look at me, I was overruled," could become his common response for him in the future. "Don't blame me if Facebook's overrun with Russian trolls. We've got a board that now helps with this." So I think that's something that we need to consider here, that this is purely a CYA move, if you will, for Zuckerberg. Now, as you also know, I'm also agnostic to politics in my reporting as much as humanly possible. I believe that cybersecurity and technology is neutral when it comes to politics. Everybody, conservative, liberal, and everybody everywhere needs this technology. And so by virtue of that, I don't really throw political stones, if you will. But I hope this governing body is going to be nonpartisan in nature. I don't know, and I did not look up the politics of each member. I just hope that this governing body is going to be fair, even if they disagree politically with the possible issue. And I think that comes down to freedom of speech, where I think you've got two, and like say in the United States, you've got two parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. Both are seen as legitimate and vying for power as the way it should be. One of them is going to be in power. The other will then be the loyal opposition. And while they may not disagree, they understand that there's a common framework that we all need to work with. When that breaks down, when one side starts seeing the other as the enemy more than a group that loves the country that just disagrees with them, that's when societies break down. So I'm hoping that this governing body is going to be nonpartisan in nature. Also, will this group also evolve into fake news and conspiracy theories that are running rampant on Facebook? You know, recently we had a film called Plandemic that was pulled from Facebook and YouTube for basically being conspiracy theory laden, according to both platforms. Basically, this lacked the scientific rigor to be a positive part of the coronavirus discussion. So what is Facebook going to do with that? Not just the controversial posts, out there that, let's say, don't meet their guidelines, but if they are being proactive in this, does this board also have to do with this? And so, whether you agree with that or not is not my concern in making that statement. What my concern is for the factual reporting that is reached and agreed upon, and then we can all judge that content for accuracy. And I think that's where we need to be. Because that's one of those things where we have an issue with, basically agreeing just on the facts. And I think that's something that we need to get above. Because if we can then create a mechanism to agree on these facts, then we can debate the solution. Then we can debate and spin it and all of that. But those facts have to be facts. That is a huge issue. It's probably a pipe dream at this point, but that's what I think, and that's what we'll see. And with that, that is your news, or your Facebook news of the week. And in some coronavirus news, we actually have cell phone data that is coming from pretty much every major carrier that is being collected and analyzed. And the New York Times got a hold of this information, and they have a report out that I think is rather interesting. Now, the New York Times basically looked at the cell phone data, and it reportedly shows that on average, 25 million more Americans left their home each day last week, meaning probably about 2 weeks ago from when you're listening to me here, compared to the preceding 6 weeks. We are now starting to really leave our homes at a much greater clip through this pandemic. Now, the average share of people staying home stood at just over 36%, which is said by researchers to be a drop of over 7% from the average during the peak period for sheltering in place. Now, this surge came as more than half of the United States, half of the states started to reopen their economies or begin making plans to do so, even though public health experts have repeatedly warned that reopening prematurely would likely cause spikes in infections and possibly that second wave. So the New York Times is also reporting that the share of people staying home last week dropped in nearly every part of the nation and in some places by nearly 11 percentage points. Now, I think that's really interesting because we have been hearing, obviously, a lot of news from this, and we have epidemiological models that are starting to show us that, some people that, let's say, were at the protests at the Michigan State Capitol, as they were driving home, some of them were coming from hundreds of miles, and they were basically possibly spreading an infection. We've seen this as well in some churches where the churches have chosen to congregate, and let's say a choir member gets it, and within a couple of weeks, most of the choir has it as well. So I think these are the things that we really need to understand. We really need to be stressing as we are looking at this. I mean, obviously, everybody wants to get back to work. Nobody wants to be furloughed or out of a job. And if you've got one, you might want to be getting back into the office, although we're going to see how that transition works, because I think there's going to be a lot of people that are basically going to be working from home now in perpetuity. And so what's that going to do to a lot of other sectors and industries, like, let's say, the commercial real estate market? And by virtue of that, if we are looking at that, everything that supports the commercial real estate market, let's say from commercial landscapers to mechanical contractors and on, might have a very serious time as everybody says, you know what, I can do my job anywhere. I can work from home. We've also seen an exodus from the San Francisco area, which by and large has the highest, average of rent around the nation, because if you can work anywhere and you don't have to directly walk into Facebook or Google or Twitter or wherever you work there, why not move to another area making the same amount of money that you have? And therefore, now here you are being a little more saving a lot more money, living maybe a little better of a lifestyle than holding up in a very small apartment there. So this is all interrelated. And if we go through a second wave, it may be because these 25 million plus are now starting to get out. So it's food for thought, but it's something that we should all be considering. And with that, that is your coronavirus tech news of the week.
And now for breaches of the week. And if you have a data breach to report that's local to you or the major news might have missed it, please, by all means, send it to me, and I'm glad to give you a shout out and include it in the radio show and possibly a daily video. And you can find me on Twitter and Facebook at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can email questions at securityfanatics.com. Again, that's questions at securityfanatics.com. And I'm more than happy to include your data breach and give you a shout out on the air. With that, let's begin.
And this week's breaches of the week, like the last radio show, my goodness, there are so many breaches. We are seeing an absolute explosion, in threat right now, whether it's phishing scams and everything else. And so the breaches keep piling up. And as you know, every Sunday I do a breaches of the week video and they just keep getting longer and longer. And if I were to do everything that I did for the last couple of weeks since the last time I was on the air, we could probably spend all hour just looking through all of these breaches. So with that, we're going to do some of the highlights of the most interesting ones, those that might affect you the most, and on and on and on. But with that, I would like to thank the following people: Jason Dance, Jacqueline Wolf, and Chris Fallon for sending me a lot of these data breaches. It always helps me out. So please feel free to send me some in any way that you can, just like I said in my preamble. And with that, we're going to be talking about Diebold Nixdorf. Now, this is a major provider of automatic teller machines and payment technology to banks and retailers, as well as makers of voting machines. And they recently suffered a ransomware attack that disrupted some of their operations. Now, according to Diebold, on the evening of Saturday, April 25th, the company's security team discovered anomalous behavior on its corporate network. Suspecting a ransomware attack, Diebold said it immediately began disconnecting systems on that network to contain the spread of the malware. Now, sources told Krebs on Security, that's Brian Krebs' blog, which I think everybody should read, that Diebold's response affected services for over 100 of the company's customers. Diebold said the company's response to the attack did disrupt a system that automates field service technician requests, but that the incident itself did not affect customer networks or the general public. So hopefully that is true and Diebold will clean that up. Obviously, we don't like to see makers of voting machines getting hit. Moving on, we're going to be talking about 4,000 different Android apps. That's right. If you have an Android phone or tablet in your life, listen up to you because you probably have a vulnerability. More than 4,000 Android apps that use Google's cloud-hosted Firebase database are unknowingly leaking sensitive information on their users, including things like email addresses, usernames, passwords, phone numbers, full names, chat messages, location data, and more. Now, this investigation was led by Bob Diachenko from Security Discovery in partnership with Comparatech. And this is basically the result of an analysis they did on 15,735 Android apps, which is roughly 18% of all apps on the Google Play Store. Now, with the most vulnerable apps in question, which is mostly games, education, entertainment, and business categories, those have been installed 4.22 billion times by Android users, meaning these 4,000-ish apps that have these vulnerabilities that they discovered have been installed 4.22 billion times by Android users. And Comparatech said, and I quote, "The chances are high that an Android user's privacy has been compromised by at least one app." This is why I always recommend not using, a singular username and password for everything, because once that password's out there or leaked, then it is gone. Even if it's super amazing and awesome and complex and all of that, if it's being stored in plain text, then I can just read it plain as day. Nothing protects it. So if you've got an Android, heads up. iPhone, people, you're safe on this one, but don't think you're off the hook, because we always see issues with iPhone apps as well, and I always report on those too. Moving on, let's talk about the U.S. Marshals Service. They suffered a cyber attack that exposed the personal information of approximately 387,000 current and former prisoners at the end of last year. This hit happened on December 30th, and this is according to that agency. And to quote the Marshals Service, the attackers were able to exploit a vulnerability in the system to extract sensitive, personally identifiable information on approximately 387,000 individuals. So if you have ever been a quote unquote guest of the U.S. Marshals Service, both current and previous, heads up to you, you may have been exposed. Moving on, we're heading down to Texas and talking about their Office of Court Administration. On Friday, May 8th, they got hit with a ransomware attack. Now, this attack began overnight and was first discovered early morning on Friday, and it took their network offline. And by virtue of that, it took the entire appellate court system for Texas offline, as well as the entire Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that is based out of Texarkana in Texas. So heads up, if you're in the Lone Star State and in the court system, you might have an issue there. Moving on, we're going to be talking about Pitney Bowes. Now, this is a $3 billion e-commerce and shipping technology provider, and they just got hit with ransomware for the second time in 6 months. And I actually remember reporting on their first data breach as well. And now this security incident was disclosed on May 12th after the Maze ransomware gang claimed online that it was able to breach and encrypt the company's network. I don't have much more information at the moment than that. But that's what's going on with Pitney Bowes. Moving on, we are heading down under to the West Australian. Now, the West Australian is Western Australia's major daily newspaper, and they said their subscription administration email had been accessed by an unauthorized third party. And now this breach occurred on March 23rd, but it wasn't brought to attention of the publication until April 22nd, when they launched an investigation. Apparently, somebody impersonated the administrator of the mailbox, sent out phishing emails to several people, and then we're actually able to access historical conversations and more. So heads up to my listeners down under, and I know I've got some. Guys, I hope you are not involved with the West Australian at the moment. Moving on, let's talk about a company called Stadler. They actually build trains. And to quote Stadler, Stadler Internal Surveillance Services found out that the company's IT network had been attacked by malware, which was most likely led to a data leak. The scale of this leak has yet to be further analyzed. So basically, Stadler says the incident is likely caused by a professional attack from a group of unknown offenders trying to probably extort money from Stadler by threatening to publicly publish information that could harm the company or its employees. That's a very common tactic. It's not just that your data gets locked out. They now threaten to publish it online if you don't pay them. So hopefully Stadler will get that cleaned up.
And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.